This is the Total Football Podcast. I'm your host, Eginhart.
And I'm Andrew Conway.
Let's get on with the show.
This fella Ronaldo is a cod.
Arsene Wenger's been in Japan for a year. He doesn't know anything about English football.
I have nothing to say. I'm so sorry, I have nothing to say.
It's the history of the Tottenham.
But this action is really incredible. Incredible.
If you don't know the answer to that question, then I think you are an ostrich.
This week, John Terry joined Twitter, and it's exactly the kind of car crash one might expect from that sentence. However, given his naive nature of replying to comments, is this as good a chance as we'll ever get to tell the Captain Leader legend what we really think?
Probably. He seems to be managing it himself, unlike Bruno Fernandes, who, funnily, his social media team posted an incorrect photograph right after the Manchester Derby at the weekend. I don't know what's motivated this PR onslaught from John Terry. I presume he's looking for a job or a role, or looking to put himself in the shop window for some of the upcoming Premier League managerial roles that may present themselves in the coming weeks. But yeah, he's a bit naive is probably the right term to put around with him, with what he's been doing on Twitter in the last few weeks, or a few days rather.
Yeah, like if I was thinking of strategies to get hired for a big job, like say the Aston Villa job, one thing I wouldn't do or advise doing is just mugging off people, strangers on Twitter, and talking about doing things with their wives, or you know, even using the pig emojis to describe certain people's wives. Just a lot of wife chat. Yeah. I'd stay very clear of all of that. That seems like a pretty bad way to get a job.
Absolutely. And yeah, it's not, I'm just reading some of the comments now that he's, you know, about Fernando, former teammates like Fernando Torres and yeah, it's punching down. It's something that was very common in Twitter in the early days, I suppose, of celebrity usage and footballer usage, but I think it's evolved a bit beyond that now, and maybe it's become a bit too sanitized. But yeah, it's a hark back to the olden days of Twitter. It's probably not going to help his employment prospects unless he gets hired by the likes of like Crystal Palace, maybe, whose owner is also a fan of such antics, like Twitter politics and Twitter, you know, football and things like that. So unless he gets a job in that kind of realm, but I do expect John Terry to be in the dugout pretty soon. Whether it's a Premier League side, I don't know if anyone is that way inclined when it comes to them. I don't know like who's available that has ambitions that align with John Terry. Like I don't like Villa being the obvious candidate, but I think Villa might aim a bit higher than John Terry, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, and it's moments like these that, you know, obviously John Terry has been kind of out of the spotlight for a while. I know he's been kind of assistant manager there for Dean Smith at Aston Villa before Smith was sacked there this week, and he played at Villa there as well for a year in the Championship. But other than that, he's not really there out in the media. He's not doing a lot of punditry work. So we kind of forget about John Terry a little, but it's in moments like these that we do remember actually that he's one of the least likable footballers I've ever seen.
Yeah, I just have to ask Wayne Bridge about that and various things. as John Terry does like making reference to wives on Twitter.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up Bruno as well, Bruno Fernandes, and that whole kind of mistake made by his PR agency, posting the good vibes post of it was three Arsenal players, Emma Smith Rowe, Gabriel Martinelli, and Moel Nenny, I think, were the three.
Yeah.
Which, obviously, not ideal in any circumstance, really, but especially after losing a Manchester Derby in such humiliating fashion. Yeah. But it's coincided as well with the, what was the CEO of media relations or something like that at Manchester United coming out and saying, basically, that all the players are micromanaged on social media, which, to be honest, we all know anyway, really. And it just kind of highlights the futile nature of all this because, you know, maybe I'm in a bubble or something. I don't know. Maybe this is different for the average person. But the only time I ever see anything to do with a player's social media account is when they've absolutely embarrassed themselves, which doesn't seem like the best approach to, you know, building a good profile.
Yeah, like, it's the eventual, it's not the end game, but it's pretty close to the end game, or the end of history of public relations of athletes and footballers in particular. Gabriel Martinelli and Bruno Fernandes shared the same PR agency, and that's why this was a faux pas happened in the first place, because they forgot where they were logged in. But yeah, the fact that everyone's managed to the nth degree, that you get no good insight, you get no good kind of a window. You know, the point of social media is to give a window into someone's life. Or at least that is one of the draws of social media. That's why normal people, the everyday person on the street, follows a social media account of a Premier League footballer like Bruno Fernandes or like anybody. And the fact that it's completely artificial and managed to the nth degree kind of devalues that. And there, whether the Man United PR guy thought he was given a big secret or not, which, you know, we all know at the bottom of our hearts what is the true, and we know that no matter what, that likely public profiles like Bruno Fernandes, like anything of any player at Manchester United, are handled and everything is vetted and checked before it goes out. You'd like to think, or you'd like to have the mystery there, that maybe behind, on his phone, tippy-tapping away, is Bruno Fernandes sharing a good vibes photo of Gabriel Martinelli for some bizarre reason after a Manchester Derby defeat. But we know, it's like politics. Like, we know that the majority of politicians don't care when someone dies, but they do put up the RIP whoever, because it's what they're expected to do. And the expectations now are that you have to have a social media, like a whole raft of different accounts, a whole load of social media accounts, and that each one of them have to be managed in a certain way. And if a world event happens, a player dies, or you have a bad game, or you lose a derby, or you win a derby, that you post an appropriate post to reflect that, and you get a certain amount of engagement. I think it's correct that it's futile, really, and it serves no purpose for the vast majority of players. And if they were to disappear in the morning, I think fan-wise, no one would care. But I think commercially for the players, I think it's very important, because it gives them, as individual athletes that are to be marketed, important data that shows, okay, we are worth X amount of money, Y amount of money, because we have this amount of followers, this amount of engagement, this amount of comments, etc. and so forth. And that helps their career in a financial sense, in a commercial sense. Other than that, I see no real value in the majority of social media accounts. Like, I think there is obviously some players that take an active interest, you know, some, or and football figures, I think Rafa Benitez was one, Ronald Koeman as well, speaking of people recently out of work, Ronald Koeman is one that actively approaches social media accounts with kind of a freshness and a kind of authenticity to it. And you have some players further down the divisions. James McLean is another one, I think, who actively manages his own social media account. But I'd say for the vast amount of top level players and managers and football people, it is a completely futile venture, and it probably isn't worth the time it takes to read these posts for people to look at them.
Yeah, like it is worth mentioning that among all the dirge of the plastic kind of fake PR speak, a lot of these players and managers go through, there are actually a few wonderful exceptions, Jose Mourinho being my absolute favorite. He will just post absolutely whatever is on his mind on Instagram, which is well worth the follow for anyone. Roy Keane is good. I know he's only a pundit now, but he's got a great Instagram game as well. I'd wish both of them.
Roy Keane has admitted his daughter runs his Instagram. Like,
true.
So, you know, it's all fake in some regard.
The Jose Mourinho one then is the most pure and delightful of them all. Never thought I'd say that.
Yeah, I suppose he is that is the one thing he's always been expert at and always been on the ball with, is probably the media manipulation. Whether he succeeds in it or not is probably up for debate, but he does involve himself in a way that probably a lot of other managers would never do, and to an extent that other managers wouldn't.
He's got that amazing rotten poster brain that really makes for the best content.
Well, yeah, he's just riling people up, or at, you know, it's exactly like his press persona. Like, he's, whether he's doing it for the age-old way that journalists want you to think he is, that he's doing it to distract from his own team and to take the pressure off his team and to put the attention on himself, or he's doing it because he's an idiot. I'm not sure, but he is doing it nonetheless.
Well, I'm going to continue to enjoy it all the same, but
yeah.
On the pitch then, I suppose we should talk about some of the results this week. Last week, we all agree that it was a good one for Chelsea, given their rivals all drop points. But this week it was Man City who gained ground. Chelsea drew 1-1 with Burnley, which I thought was a bit of a weird result. Didn't get to see that game. Curious as to how that unfolded. But then Liverpool went and lost 3-2 on Sunday to West Ham, which I did get to see, and that was an incredible game.
Yeah, well, first to go to the Chelsea match before we go to the antics in London, or in the London Stadium. Chelsea welcomed Burnley. Burnley offered very little, but were stout in defence for a lot of the match. I think Chelsea were knocking on the door. There was one humorous scene right before the first goal where Havertz went off the pitch, was kind of elbowed off the pitch and went and landed in the fans, and the referee didn't even notice. He was gone, and like, he was behind the advertising hoardings and the game was going on, and like, there was like the fans trying to say that your man is down here and he's kind of like dead. And then minutes later, there was a goal. But yeah, I think Chelsea failed to really put away their opportunities and to kill off Burnley. And really, Burnley could have had it at the end. There was opportunities for Burnley to actually steal a win in stoppage time, which really would have you know, really would have put Chelsea out. But yeah, I think similar to a few games I've seen Chelsea play, like they're obviously very attacking with the players they have on the field, but I think at certain points, if they run out of chances or they run out of ideas to actually convert chances, they kind of turn into a kind of, what's the word for it? Stuck in the mud type of team, where they're just passing the ball around for the sake of passing the ball around. Classic Chelsea under Sarri almost. And that does always leave the door open if you can't put the goals into the back of the net, that teams can come back at you. Chelsea so far this season have proven very capable of defending, and they've only, before this match, was they only had 3 goals conceded, and they're on track to beat their own record for fewest goals conceded in the Premier League season. I don't know if they'll get there, but yeah, I think that's saved them so far this season when they've kind of been very passive in their play. But yeah, they're still top. But I'll let you lead on the West Ham Liverpool match.
Yeah, just the only thing I'd say about that Chelsea game is observing the 3 o'clock games. It was very unusual for them to go 1-0 up, and at that point you kind of think, okay, they're going to see this one out comfortably. You don't even need to watch it to know what's happening, and then suddenly you see it's 1-1 and they don't find the winner, and it's very unusual. And I do wonder, having not seen the game, how much they were missing Romelu Lukaku, because that is the kind of game where, you know, 1-0 up and you're struggling to kind of put it away, and Lukaku is good for knocking in 2 to make it 3-0 and you know, happy faces all around at Stamford Bridge. So, you know, we're seeing there as well how injuries are kind of affecting the table as well and some of the results, because, you know, it wasn't just in this game that there were injuries in that Liverpool game as well. And their midfield has been the big concern. Fabinho was back in this game, and I thought, you know, that might make Liverpool a bit more solid, but, you know, it was quite surprising to see him get bullied off the ball by Antonio, who I know is a very physical striker and is very difficult to handle. So, you know, there are exceptions to be made for top midfielders when they come up against top strikers. But, you know, I do wonder, was this a case of he was rushed back from injury? Was he not fully ready? You know, this was a big game because West Ham are to be respected. They're in the top 4 even before this game, and now they're above Liverpool with this result. So, you know, David Moyes' footballing genius is the moral of the story.
Yeah, like, it may be, to be honest. And especially with West Ham playing extra matches this season, you'd expect them to be a bit more tired. But they are well up for this match. And David Moyes had clearly had a game plan set up for going out. Like, they were targeting Alisson. They were putting pressure on the ball in certain parts of the game. They were very much focusing and funneling all of their efforts through the centre midfield to stifle both Liverpool's attack and the ability for them to drop deep and to play that kind of false nine role, as well as their players to come inside, which gave Liverpool a lot of space on the wings. But then West Ham have a huge amount of tall, very physically domineering players in the centre of defence, and they were able to repel a lot of Liverpool's attacks during the match. And then it only took kind of West Ham to come in and really steal their, not steal their opportunities, but really seize their opportunities in the game, put away goals. And Liverpool were just, I don't want to say shell-shocked, but they were certainly taken aback by the ferocity of pace that the chances came, and West Ham didn't waste them, which a lot of teams, I suppose, against Liverpool this season maybe aren't as eager to convert their chances as West Ham were in this match. And like, Liverpool had chances to get back into it, but they just couldn't. They couldn't put the ball in the back of the net, and I think that's a lot down to the way that David Moyes and these West Ham players applied themselves in this game.
Yeah, like, you know, the goals were all quite strange. Obviously, the game starts with that kind of very odd direct goal from a corner. I think it went down as an own goal for Alisson, which was a bit, I suppose, harsh on him. I don't know, did he get a proper touch on the ball? But, you know, obviously, it's a great delivery from Fornals. Bit of debate over whether it was a foul or not. Personally, I don't think it was. I don't think it really matters either, because the goal was given. We just have to move on. And from there, West Ham, they did sit back in a way that I thought maybe was detrimental to their ability to get a result out of this, and ultimately it did lead to Liverpool scoring. And Liverpool did have a couple of decent chances in that first half, and they were definitely, you know, knocking on the door. But it was really in the second half then at 1-1 that West Ham came out a bit more, and you realise, like, why didn't they do this in the first half? They could have killed the game off, really, and then they get to pretty well worked goals. That counter attack to make it 2-1 I thought was fantastic. Their own from Jared Bowen, you know, he draws four men on him, none of them stick a leg out, which was kind of crazy. And then he draws in the fifth player, which I think was Joel Matip, who just leaves Fornals kind of open, and Fornals, you know, was a good finish. And from there, you know, West Ham were really knocking on the door from that. They could have been 3 or 4-1 up almost immediately, just because but for Virgil van Dijk, who, you know, gave us a good reminder that he's still a top, top quality centre-back, who, you know, was absolutely raging at one point at, I think it was Fabinho, who had been bullied off the ball by Antonio, which led to a counter-attack, which then I think led to the third goal going in on the corners. And West Ham as well, we should also mention as well, just how good they are on set pieces, because every game I watch them, they look like they're going to score from a corner. It doesn't matter who they're playing against, and that's just so impressive. Obviously, they have, you know, players suited to that. Kurt Zouma is really good. Ogbonna is great. Antonio's great header of the ball, the Czech as well. Lads. Yeah, Suchek as well, who's basically the new Fellaini. Like, they've got a lot of attacking threat in the box there when it's a set piece, but the fact that they utilize that as well, like, a lot of teams have, you know, very physical, commanding players in the box, but they don't utilize it well with poor set piece delivery, you know, boring set piece routines. But yeah, West Ham consistently, like, they have the most goals from set pieces since David Moyes took over by a large margin, as far as I'm aware. And, you know, you can see in every game why that is, because they look so dangerous in every game, and it gets them like a free goal almost every game as well, which is so massive, big part of why they're getting so many results.
Yeah, and they have, like, speaking of goals, they have scored a lot more goals than you might have given them credit for this season. They are up there, only Chelsea, whose stats are quite frankly padded by that 7-0 victory, and Liverpool have more goals than them this season. And they're defensively, they're not doing too badly either in terms of conceding of goals. They have, like, a good goalkeeper, a good solid base in there with Fabianski and all those players that you just listed before. So they are impressive in that regard, and probably a lot better than we give them credit for. It'll be interesting to see whether it's sustainable, the way they're going, because for large swathes, and I said this to you off air, like, for large swathes that match, they were second best to Liverpool in a lot of the game, but when they clicked, they just looked unstoppable. They looked like they were dominating Liverpool in some of those moments in the second half, and, you know, when things worked on set pieces and stuff like that, they just looked like they were in a different division than Liverpool. I'd be very interested to see how things progress over the rest of the season, if they can sustain this through Christmas, because they legitimately could put a run together to like leave them within contention for Champions League, given how last season went and how legitimately they were in the conversation right up until the last couple of weeks of the year, really, of the season. And could they do it again, and could they go that one step further, considering the flux that does appear to be in place above them with kind of an unknown quantity placed on that fourth Champions League spot? I think we're fairly confident that there's going to be, I know we're at an early stage, 11 games gone in the season, but we're fairly sure that Chelsea, Man City and Liverpool will probably make the Champions League this season. And that last spot might be open as things stand.
Yeah, and right now I think that they're putting up the numbers, they're putting up the argument to say that they can fight for that fourth place, if not they're the favourites right now, because, you know, we haven't seen how Antonio Conte is going to do it at Tottenham just yet. I think Arteta is still kind of not there with Arsenal. Obviously, you know, Manchester United, what else needs to be said? So, you know, there's definitely room there for West Ham, and they're getting those points on the board that we talked about last week. You know, the interesting thing as well is, like you say, that they didn't look as good as Liverpool in the first half. Like, you know, in theory, we should be saying that every week about whoever Liverpool play. Like, they are one of the best teams in Europe, but that then West Ham for 45 minutes or so did go toe-to-toe with Liverpool, shows that they are, you know, one of the best teams in the country at the moment. And what's interesting as well is that, like, you're right to point out that they're juggling Europa League quite well, but the other thing is that their performances in Europa League have also been really good. Like, they've got 10 points from 4 games, I think, now. They will surely top that group from what I can recall. They, you know, they're rotating players in and out. I know Declan Rice played 90 minutes in Belgium the Thursday beforehand, and he still was able to play against Liverpool. Like, the fact that they're managing that very well, some players are being rested, some aren't. You know, they're doing a great job there, and I think that's a testament to how good they are, that they can juggle those things in a way that, say, a Wolves or a Burnley or a Southampton or even a West Ham in the past haven't been able to do. Not even Leicester have been able to do that, really. Because looking at the field in the Europa League now as well, obviously we don't know who's going to drop down from the Champions League, but of the teams competing in the Europa League right now, you know, it's hard to look past them as performing the best of anyone, which is you know, a crazy thing to think about, really, and they should, if they can keep this going, which of course remains to be seen, but if they can keep this going, then they, you know, they could be looking at winning the Europa League this year, which is, again, just a crazy thing to think about, given, you know, David Moyes seemed like such an odd appointment. Yeah. There was very little hype around him.
Reappointment, he'd
done a decent job the first time around, but, you know, they let him run down the contract. And it was a case of, oh, we'll bring in a top manager, Manuel Pellegrini, who really underperformed with those players. And then David Moyes has come in, and he's got players playing excellent football. You know, Mikel Antonio looks like he should be playing for a Champions League team if he isn't next season with West Ham. Declan Rice obviously has grown into this really important midfielder for them. You know, a leader for England as well. And you know, likely a top target for some of the bigger clubs in the summer as well, if they don't make the top four. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, probably the best work of David Moyes' career. It is very nice to see him get this moment of redemption, I guess, so far. And I do hope that they can keep this going, because it's genuinely exciting. It's very fun to see a different team succeed from the usual suspects of the big six teams. And that David Moyes is the face of it gives it that extra value, I think.
Yeah, they're doing it in, like, I'm not saying they're doing it the wrong way, but they're doing it in a different way to what we're seeing at the other established clubs as well. They're not trying to play, you know, kind of horrible football. They're not trying to play a copy of what the top sides do. They're doing their own thing. And it's working for them, and you know, I expect them in the new year to sign a few players as well that'll probably help to sustain things. They might get Jesse Lingard back if they hold on to Miguel Antonio, maybe get him a bit more support in kind of something, a plan B or some kind of different attacking option through the middle. That would be great as well. And really, they have to see if they can have a tilt at this. Like, it is still early days, relatively speaking. Like, there is still a lot that can happen in the season, and because of the congested nature of the table at the moment as well, there's a lot of other teams that potentially could break into that zone as well and give them challenge before the end of the year. But so far, so good for West Ham.
And the significant thing about West Ham is that their underlying numbers are about as good as Chelsea's, which is, you know, we're thinking of Chelsea as a title contender. And, you know, the underlying numbers also suggest that Liverpool and Man City are, you know, far above these two teams. But, you know, if you get a hot streak going, you know, football is a game of variance as much as it is anything. And, you know, if West Ham can get that bit of luck as well, there's no reason why they can't, you know, keep this up and challenge for the league as well. Because, you know, we have to remember they've only lost, what, two games this season. One of them was a last-minute winner from Jesse Lingard for Manchester United. Another was a last-minute winner, you know, for Brentford. So, you know, if they hold on in those two games, or if Mark Noble scores that penalty against Man United, they're an extra 2 points, and they're unbeaten.
They're top of the league.
You know, very, very close to being top of the league based on their results and performances so far. Yeah. And that's, again, just a testament to how good they've been this season.
Yeah, two of their three next games are against Chelsea and Man City, so we'll, along with two Europa League matches thrown in there for good measure. So we'll see. I think that'll be a nice little test for David Moyes. But I don't see them coming out with less than maybe 3 points from those two, something in and around that from those two games. So you know, I would fancy them against Chelsea, to be quite honest. I think they have what it takes to beat them. Man City might be a bit different, but as we've talked about earlier in this season, and last week was a testament to it, there's no one unbeatable in this league, and there's no one that's really head and shoulders above anybody else. And that's why we're so congested, and we have a 2 point spread between 6th and 12th place at the moment. You know, that it is a very competitive league at the moment.
And then just moving on, what else really is there left to say about Man United, given their current state? It was a 2-0 loss to Man City. It was could have been more, should have been more. It was humiliating. It was embarrassing. Is there anything else to say?
I don't know. Apparently, they're blaming Donny van der Beek for it now, because that makes sense. They don't seem to be angling for a move. I think they lost their opportunity at getting the best possible Manchester United manager that's available at the moment in Antonio Conte going to Spurs. So they kind of have left themselves with no other option but to persevere with Solskjaer, I think, at this point. Like, because what are they going to do? The Champions League qualification isn't settled yet. So is that the bugbear, you know, similar to what happened with Van Gaal, similar to what happened with Mourinho when it looked like they weren't going to get Champions League qualification. Is that what is, you know, is that the be all and end all for Manchester United, for the Glazers, that you have to be certain of missing out in the Champions League and then you'll be sacked the manager and nothing else to do with anything else?
I don't think it's going to be as simple as, oh, they mathematically can't get top four and that's the day that Solskjaer's reign ends. It's either going to be that they just ride it out for the rest of the season, they settle with finishing 11th or whatever and call it a day then, or they pull the plug soon. Frankly, it should have happened against Liverpool, and it should happen every subsequent day since. You know, a Man United manager just can't lose 5-0 like that at Old Trafford against Liverpool. It shouldn't be that they can continue after that, no matter who you are. So then there's the other thing that you say of, like, oh well, they missed out on Conte, so that means there's no one else really available. And I think that is something that we would only say about Man United. Like, if Chelsea were looking for a manager right now, we'd be listing off 6-7 names. Like, we're not saying there's no one else is good enough. We're saying that the Glazers,
confidence. They won't appoint a big name. They won't not appoint a big name.
It's not even that. It's just because, like, Solskjaer wasn't a big name, but, you know, the like Louis van Gaal was, like, obviously he's a big name, but is he really a big name at that point in his career either? You know, it's very muddled over there. And the other thing that comes to mind is just, do they even know the names of any other managers? Like, have they even heard of anyone that isn't apparently Maurizio Pochettino, who, you know, will forever be linked with that job, I feel, but never get it the way things are going. You know, it just speaks to apathy from the owners. That and again, we're going back into a conversation that we've had loads about how the Glazers are just bad owners. Ed Woodward is a bad CEO for this type of decision making. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty even as to what power he holds at the club right now. And it's really just obviously the season feels a bit like a write-off for Man United, which is, you know, I think embarrassing and humiliating as well.
It's early still as well, like, there's a season to recover, yeah.
And that's the problem, is it feels very defeatist that, oh, sure, why... look at doing anything different, and you know, we'll just stay with Solskjaer or whatever. Like, the other thing as well is that it doesn't make fiscal sense to stick with Solskjaer, even though it's apparent that everything is gone, just because you'll save a bit of money, you know, with some clause about not having to pay off as much in the Champions League. Like, the money you lose by not making the Champions League and not being a Champions League club is surely outweighs that. And I think that came into play as well with when Jose Mourinho was sacked, that they realised that they were set to lose out on more money than what they would lose if they just stuck with Mourinho until that moment came. So, you know, I don't think Solskjaer will last to Christmas if they keep playing like this, and really there's nothing to suggest that anything will change. So it just feels like they're delaying the inevitable for no apparent reason. And that just leaves us with very little left to say about it, which is just kind of sad.
Well, when you say it like
it's
that,
funny.
It really doesn't get, yeah, like it's they're,
but
they're,
it's also
but
sad.
They've created their own misery. Like, they've created their yeah. own problems. Like, they spent so much money in the summer. They've spent so much money in the past. So it is, I don't think you can, you have Roy Keane or other pundits there saying, oh, these players aren't good enough, and the players, it's all about the players, this and that, and it's about the, you know, David De Gea is a good player, you know. Eric Bailly is a good player. You can't just scapegoat him at halftime. Lindelof, you know, is an international level, good international level player. You know, Harry Maguire, Luke Shaw, Wan-Bissaka. It's not a case that, you know, apart from the fact that their transfer fees are enormous, it's not a case that these players are bad by any stretch of the imagination. They just aren't functioning well together. And they need a different direction, and it's not coming.
Like, there is this massive disconnect that really doesn't help Manchester United. It's really specific to them right now, in that they have the most famous pundit in the UK is probably Gary Neville. If it's not him, it's Jamie Carragher, but we'll say it's Gary Neville for this argument. You've got the most famous pundit in the UK who is clearly, you know, as a former player of the club, he's also a massive fan of the club, and he's going out there and he's saying all these things about how bad Man United are, that you look at and you go, well, they're something that the manager would be involved with. And then he turns around and he says, and it's because of the players that these are happening, and I won't ever ask for the manager to get sacked. And then there's the extra added layer that he's former teammates with that guy who's manager of Manchester United, and he's good mates with them. And it just leads to this discourse where, you know, at the end of a Man United or Manchester derby where Man United are absolutely humiliated, a lot of people spend their time talking about Gary Neville and not the inherent problems that are going on in the background of Manchester United. Because at this point, I do feel a lot of sympathy for the Man United players, who just clearly don't look coached. They don't look like they know what they're really supposed to do. You know, they're talking about how they lack belief now. And, you know, with the way they're performing, I can see how they'd lose confidence, because everything just, again, looks so muddled, confused, and, yeah, just poorly managed. And they're not well coached, and it's no wonder they're performing so poorly.
Yeah, like I think at this point it does look to a team that's given up on the manager, to be quite honest, and probably, I don't know, like maybe things can work with Solskjaer at the helm, but like not in the current structures, not in a way where he, you know, there is no clear direction of player recruitment, there is no clear direction of play, there is no clear hierarchy of answering for problems, you know, when something happens, there has to be answers, you know, and when there's a question raised, there, generally speaking, it's the manager's responsibility or the club's responsibility to come out and answer a question, and there hasn't been any answers for this. I don't think, what did Solskjaer said in the last few weeks, oh yeah, we've trained harder, like what does that even mean? What are you going to do to arrest the problems that caused a 5-0 defeat? Oh, you revert back to a system you used before the lockdown when things were starting to look bad for you the first time around, and hopefully that'll change things, and it doesn't really. It results in you scraping a draw in the Champions League and then losing again to your nearest rivals. I don't think they're a response. I think he's been given chances to rectify the situation, and I think he's been given them in the past, and it's worked out for him, and the players have delivered for him. But at this point, maybe it's Ronaldo's destabilizing presence now that means that the players can't respond in a way that's good enough to one of these defeats. But yeah, the writing's been on the wall for a long time, and it looks like it's going to continue to be on the wall for another while yet.
Yeah, and just finally, the point that I would make is that when a different club, when I look at an Arsenal or an Aston Villa or a Newcastle, well, maybe not Newcastle right now, but when I look at a Man City, when they make a decision, you know, a lot of the time I'll go, well, I'm not sure about that, but also I trust those people to make those decisions. They know a lot more about football than I do. But when some of the decisions are made about Manchester United, and some of these are Solskjaer's decisions, I just wonder, like, this guy's living in the past. He doesn't understand the modern game at all. And some of it is just, like, complete, like, what even is the word? Like, it's just totally stupid. Like, certain decisions, like playing Harry Maguire, even though he's clearly not fit and he's clearly not able to perform to his normal standard because he can't run properly anymore. And, like, you know, not being able to run is going to hamper every part of your game, not just your ability to run. You know, just stuff like that. Why are they playing Harry Maguire? Why are they playing Luke Shaw, who's also seemingly suffering from the same problems? Why was it Marcus Rashford last year? Why did they switch to a back three? You know, was it a case that they thought, well, an extra defender will make the defense better? Or was it a case that, you know, it was just we have to change something and here's something different? Why did they sign Rafael Varane when it was clear that they, you know, had a decent centre-back partnership between Lindelof and Maguire and they actually had gaping hole in midfield instead? And, you know, their idea of shoring up
because
defense,
of social media engagement. Like,
and that, again, comes back to why did they sign Ronaldo? Nostalgia. You know, the opportunity arose and they decided to pounce. It was not a part of a coherent long-term strategy. It was poor decision-making. And again, as an armchair pundit who, you know, has no experience in the game as a player, or as, I don't know, my coaching badges or anything, it should never be a case where I look at a club and think, why? I should be thinking, oh, I trust these people to make those decisions. And, you know, it might seem a bit weird, but they've probably got their reasons. A lot of the time, Solskjaer, like, I wonder what reason at all could he have for some of these decisions?
Yeah, like, they don't seem rooted in a good approach to football. Like, it doesn't even seem rooted in a good approach to kind of satiating fans when you think about it. Because it's a lot of, what would you say? It's a lot of, the decisions were made above his head. Fair enough. Ronaldo was appointed. Varane was brought in. Players were signed when there was other players that were probably better needed that they were after. Resources were allocated in different ways. But once you're in there, you're in there. You have to make the right calls for the team. And, you know, satisfying a former teammate in Ronaldo ahead of maybe your own team performance or, you know, changing the way you play and then the personnel you choose to use in that, playing injured players, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And yeah, I think there will be an interesting post-mortem when this eventually does end to see why did things happen the way they did. The way that Manchester United leaks, I wouldn't think it would take too long for that to materialise, and especially if certain players leave this summer, I'd say Paul Pogba would be an interesting person to hear from in the summer to see if we can actually get an understanding what has gone down in the Manchester United dressing room the last year or so.
Dean Smith and Daniel Farke joined this season's ever-growing list of sacked managers. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is surely chewing the post soon too. Eddie Howe has come in at Newcastle. Antonio Conte manages first Premier League game at Spurs as Spurs boss this week. What does it all mean? What is the point of this managerial merry-go-round?
I think it's horses for courses. I think Tottenham made a bad appointment in the summer. I think everyone would acknowledge of that. And Nuno probably would acknowledge it, that he wasn't the right man for that point, and maybe he should have taken a bit of a sabbatical from football after leaving Wolves to kind of get his verve back and start again. Maybe England isn't the right place for him at this point in his career. And Conte has come in there, and he's probably the person Spurs really wanted to appoint in the summer, but now he's been given an 11 or 10 game handicap to settle things up, and he's starting now with 30 points off the board that were there at the beginning of the season and grow from it. Newcastle are in a very similar position where they have been waiting for this takeover to happen for several years now, and it's happened mid-season, and they're going to appoint their man that they think will take them from where they are at the moment, which is you know, a relegation threatened club, a club that may still go down this season, to a club that can initially first establish themselves as a firm Premier League side atop the top side of the table, of top 10 Premier League side, and then kick on from there, whether it's Eddie Howe doing it at that point or not. The other clubs, it does just seem like a bit of a let's hurl stuff at the wall and hopefully we can stay in this this Premier League carnival for another year and take all the money in. That certainly seems to be the appointments made by Watford and whatever Aston Villa end up doing. It's just, you know, okay, we're going to have a go at this and see what happens, and if this doesn't work, we'll try someone else in a couple of months' time.
Yeah, like, I suppose we should start the conversation with the easiest one, which is Antonio Conte, who is just a world-class manager, and is easily a really as safe a bet, you would think, as anyone at this point because of his track record. I know some people might think he could be volatile, but at the very least, he should start off pretty well. And, you know, at the moment, I would put Tottenham right in that top four conversation based purely on the fact that Antonio Conte is that good of a manager. So the dynamic of the league there has changed with this appointment, which is good. It's going to be exciting, you know, of those traditional big six clubs that we've seen in the past. Tottenham are the ones that I think, you know, they're the ones that got up there through their own hard work the most. So they're the ones that, you know, obviously when they have something go wrong, they were still one of the Super League teams. So it is funny when that does happen, but you know, when they turn it around, it's not this criminal act that maybe the day Man United start doing well again, it might be a criminal of like, oh, why didn't we all enjoy this a bit more that they were doing so poorly. But with the other three, it's all quite interesting. Daniel Farke, will he go down as the worst manager in Premier League history to manage this many games? Because he hung on by hook or by crook, and he even went out with a win. Style.
Yeah, like, what does he have? 50-odd matches, or nearly 50 Premier League matches under his belt, and very few victories in that collection. I'm unsure of what Norwich's strategy was now that they've sacked Farke. I think I saw them described as a team too good for the Championship, too bad for the Premier League. And that seems to be the model they're fitting into at the moment. They sold their best player into coming into the season, whether he's not really lit the world alight at Aston Villa, so whether he was good enough for this level or not, I'm not sure, and Buendia. But surely they're leaving themselves with no replacement, having no creativity, having no real way of scoring by relying on a Finnish player in his early 30s. I'm not sure if that was the best strategy going into a Premier League season with a similar team to when you got relegated a year earlier. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Norwich do, because they don't operate on the same budget as other Premier League teams. That's been made abundantly clear. Even smaller level teams, they aren't an Aston Villa, they aren't a Watford. They have to, you know, make do with what they get. They're punching above their weight, even being in the division. So, Farke getting them relegated, I think maybe it was a one humiliation too much by perhaps getting the lowest point to Sally ever before that victory happened at the weekend. I think it's still possible. Is it 5 points? Is all? What is the Derby County's record at the moment?
I think it was 11 points. Might have been 12.
Yeah, so it's still within possibility, though unlikely, that Norwich could break that record, and maybe that was what they were afraid of. Julius Smith and the board at Norwich, that get somebody else in. But like, I think they were good with Farke in terms of their long-term planning, or at least they seem to be. So I'd hope they'd appoint someone of equal stature and, you know, someone who plays similar football, if maybe not the same kind of redundant loss-making football. But I would be very disappointed if Norwich went the 180 and decided to appoint like a Neil Warnock, since he's now become available, you know, that type of manager, to try and bring something about, because I don't see Norwich getting out of the relegation mire, even though they're only 5 points off safety at the moment. But I find it very unlikely that no matter who they bring in or who they can attract, they don't necessarily have the players or the budget. Even if they do get their players to play it above their level, they'll be sold in the winter window. So yeah, I don't know what they're going to do by go back down to the Championship, so they need to start building for that right now.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of excited to see what they do, because I'm confident that they won't go for one of those gunmen for hire. Well, Dean Smith is now available, I guess. I don't even think they'd hire Dean Smith. Just not anything against the guy. I just don't think
that's... He's not an unprogressive manager. He's just not.
No, he's not. Managed Brentford as well in the past and did well there too. And,
yeah,
you know, we'll talk about Dean Smith's Aston Villa reign, I suppose, in a couple of minutes. But it's interesting. Stuart Webber is the name of the guy who's kind of in charge of this at Norwich. He's appointed two managers in his history. You know, one at Huddersfield, he appointed David Wagner there, and he appointed Daniel Farke here at Norwich when he moved over. And the one thing both of those men have in common, not only were they managing in German football, but they were managing for the Borussia Dortmund B team, which is certainly a playbook. You know, it's definitely a left field approach. I think the Brexit rules mean they can't just do the same thing again. Not that, you know, that's necessarily what they were thinking, but maybe they'll take a similar approach. Maybe they'll go to Austria or something, or they'll go to France and make some left field appointment there. And I think that's quite exciting that they are willing to operate in a much different way to a lot of clubs. And you're right that they work on a much smaller budget than the rest, but they do well to work within their means. You know, they have a much smaller budget than even some of the championship clubs, and they're consistently winning that league whenever they're in it. So, you know, they are a well-run club. They know what they're doing. They're not overspending. They're not, you know, jeopardizing the future of the club for a bit of a short-term gain, which is, you know, what hiring a Big Sam would do. I'm excited to see what they do, just because I think I trust them to do something a little different, a little odd. And, you know, they might end up losing the next, 27 games in the league this season. But, you know, I think they might do it in a charming way. So I'm looking forward to that.
You know, it's nice. It's nice to be a nice place to go. You know, Fulham had that distinction for a long time in the Premier League, and even in recent years as well. So maybe Norwich can take up that mantle.
And I suppose we should talk about Dean Smith as well, who, you know, there's a lot of question marks around him as to, you know, how much was it that he did a good job and how much of it was that Jack Grealish was actually just really good. And, you know, it's a bit harsh to kind of phrase it like that, because I think, you know, as good as any star player can be, you know, it takes a good manager to utilize that in a system that gets them points, gets them goals, and gets them, you know, big wins that they got and some really good performances. So I think Dean Smith did a really good job to kind of maximize what they were doing when they had Jack Grealish. And since then, yeah, I was very surprised to look at the league table and see that they are 16th. I know they lost 5 games in a row, but, you know, they did win at Old Trafford as well, although, you know, everyone's doing that these days.
But does seem like that a bit.
A bit, yeah. But, you know, obviously he's got the ties to the club as well, being a fan, and he left Brentford for them when maybe sticking with Brentford would have been the safer bet for him, and those emotional ties do make it a bit sadder to see him go. I kind of get where some people come from, and they say that it's harsh because they probably won't get relegated if they stuck with them. But at a certain point, with the money that they spent, you know, even factoring in for the fact that they made a lot of money off Jack Grealish, they still spent quite a lot of money. And, you know, they should be ambitious enough to go for your European football. So in that sense, I do think it's good that they've ripped off the Band-Aid, because it shows that they want more than just mid-table mediocrity. And with the players that they have, they should be more than 16th. Like, they have some really good players. You mentioned Emi Buendia. Ollie Watkins, I think, is really exciting. I quite like Leon Bailey as well. He's looked very good the few minutes that he's got on the pitch. So that, you know, signing Danny Ings was an interesting one, though. It maybe gave them a bit of a tactical problem with the switch to a back three not really working. But, you know, they have some really exciting players. John McGinn as well, El Ghazi. You know, they have some decent players there that is better than 16th.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I think it's the run of games that they've... the fact that he didn't look like getting them out, that they're in a bit of a tailspin, and that things weren't materializing in the ways. You know, Buendia, Bailey were supposed to be their big signings from the summer. Ings came in as an opportunistic buy more than anything, I think, at the end of it. I think, they are defensively solid, very much so. I think they have a good goalkeeper, a good base with Tyrone Mings. And I think most of the time they do well with that. Away from defence, there were issues. Like, they weren't getting the best out of their midfield. I think Cash and the other Matt, what's the guy on the other side of a target?
Matt Target.
have regressed this season and weren't doing their defensive duties correctly. I thought Tyrone Mings not lashing out at both of them, but, you know, lecturing both of them in multiple matches in the last few weeks. I've noticed that, and you know, when you see that the players that were kind of loyal to Smith that came up with him from the Championship weren't performing anymore, you might look at Smith and like, you need to be dropping these guys and kicking them out, and maybe he was giving too much loyalty to these players. And I think that might have been one of the things that might have forced the hand of the board at Villa to kind of say, okay, we need someone who isn't associated with this to kind of, as you said, rip the band-aid and really progress this team more and more forward. Like, the Jack Grealish thing I can hear and understand, but he missed a lot of last season, and Villa still did well, although less well when he wasn't around. And, you know, I think a lot of that can be down to the way Smith managed the team. And he is a good coach, like, he's a good manager, but maybe, like you said, his ceiling is a bit lower than where Villa believe they can be.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting to see who they appoint, because there's been a lot of really random names thrown out, and some of them are a bit surprising. Frank Lampard, Roberto Martinez in particular, you know, they aren't hugely inspiring. Yeah, I'm sure they'd love to do John Terry dream team.
I like, if they want to get the best out of Buendia, Leon Bailey, Danny Ings, Ollie Watkins, and maybe get something back from these other English players that they've had since Championship days, as well as making the best out of the defence, because I think with the defence that they have, it is very capable and very solid, and maybe the back three isn't working for them, but they can do other things. And I don't see Frank Lampard, Bobby Di Matteo, you know, it's a Tim Sherwood-like appointment, which, you know, the Villa have done in the past, but it would be a 180 appointment, and I don't necessarily think that's the right idea. They should be aiming higher. They should be going up the division and looking at, you know, managers who, like, who will be, like, maybe Mourinho will be available soon. But, you know, managers who, you know, who else were Spurs linked with? That's the manager level they should be looking at, not at, you know, managers who Spurs wouldn't even consider. Like, why would you consider a manager that wouldn't be considered by your immediate rivals? And I think Villa believe that they are a big club and believe that they should be up in the conversation with the likes of Newcastle, as their new money now, but with the likes of Spurs, of Arsenal, of Leicester, of Everton. Like, why can't they be linked with international grade managers and not the rejects of other teams?
Yeah, I agree with that as well. And I think picking up Frank Lampard would really feel like that. You know, yeah. It's going to be interesting to see where Lampard goes next, just because, you know, there's such a mighty downfall from getting unceremoniously sacked from Chelsea, who then the replacement comes in and wins the Champions League and immediately makes them title contenders. So, you know, I don't think Villa are his level either. I think Villa are above that. But interestingly, his midfield partner for England might be within a shout as well. I think that will be a much more interesting appointment. Steven Gerrard, who, you know, has won the league with Rangers, you know, in a very difficult atmosphere and environment there, given Celtic had won, what, 9 in a row there and were ever dominant, and Rangers had been, you know, they'd gone into liquidation, they'd gotten up to the SPL, but they'd struggled to really, you know, challenge Celtic, and Gerrard has made them do that, and you know, winning a league title at the end of it is a great reward, and he's done a really good job there from all accounts. And I think if Gerrard wants to manage Liverpool one day, which, you know, I'd be amazed if he doesn't, taking a job like Aston Villa for a couple of years is a perfect step up for him, because really, you know, obviously it would be sad for Rangers to lose a manager who's been successful with them, and, you know, it would maybe feel a bit harsh for them. But, you know, winning the league title at Rangers, what else more is there to do? You know, you've knocked Celtic off their perch a little. You've brought the good times back to the Ibrox. You know, there's only really one direction after that, and that's down. So, you know, moving to Aston Villa, I think that will be really exciting. I really hope that's the direction they go in. Because we have seen Gerrard linked with the Everton job in the summer, which would have been fascinating if that had happened. And we talk about how Aston Villa were really defensively solid under Dean Smith. Like, you know, that would suit Gerrard down to the ground. That Rangers side were a brick wall in front of goal, there in their league winning undefeated campaign, which was really impressive. They just didn't concede goals at all. They didn't even concede chances, really. You know, it was hugely impressive and a bedrock for why they won that league title. So, you know, if he could go in there, you know, even improve the defense there a little and then get something out of the attackers, like, you know, that's a formula for success right there.
Yeah, like, when you say it like that, it's also simple. And why don't they get ahead and do it? We'll see whether they do or not. I'd be surprised if they do go that way, but that's just my cynicism coming through. That they are going to go and appoint someone silly, aren't they?
They were linked with Paolo Fonseca as well, which, you know,
yeah,
I don't
that
think
would
be
a very
terrible
progressive appointment. Like I think he did very well for Roma, considering different things that happened at Roma in the last few years and the change of ownership and
true
and different things like that. Like, where Italian football is and where, you know, the level of players that they had available to them and the fact that they'd have to sell core members of their team every year, multiple years in a row, you know, that's, I think he did excellently well and plays a very interesting style of football. I think that would maybe work in the Premier League. We'll see. It did seem to have an impact in the Champions League or in Europe when he was in there. So yeah, we'll see what happens, but yeah, like I fear that they're going to do a Tim Sherwood on it.
Yeah, and I suppose the end point that we put on Aston Villa is that ultimately they'd be doing a lot of work to go down this season, because like they have quality players. There's four or five teams, let alone three, that are much worse than them. So, you know, it'll be very impressive if they manage to appoint someone who will do a job bad enough that they go down this season. So they have that safety net to kind of get it wrong, I suppose, and see where they are again in the summer if it all sinks after that. So, you know, that I suppose helps them. But I think I'd like to think that would help them go risky and appoint someone like Fonseca or Gerrard, because I think that both of those would be so exciting in a hugely competitive league. But I suppose finally then we should talk about Eddie Howe coming in at Newcastle. We've talked about Eddie Howe a lot over the couple of years since he left Bournemouth, and even when he was at Bournemouth, of like, oh, maybe this team will pick up Eddie Howe. Finally, someone has brought in the man who only seems to work in Bournemouth. You know, can he do it in Newcastle?
It's your definition of success and what is do it. Like, I think he can, but I think he can bring them up to like a team that can relatively comfortably stay in the top 10 of the Premier League, a la maybe where Leicester or Crystal Palace or Everton are at the moment, given significant investment that will be present and available to Newcastle, we expect. I think he can do okay with them. Beyond that, I'm not entirely sure. Like, very seldom do we see, and this is much to the chagrin of a lot of managers in England, very seldom do we see an opportunity given to a young English manager these days, and maybe this is the opportunity of a lifetime for Eddie Howe, and he can build them into a Champions League powerhouse. I don't think he can do that at the moment, and based on what I think about Eddie Howe and given how badly he did at Burnley when he went up there, but given that he'll have a lot of financial backing, it's possible.
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on Burnley there, because obviously he had a very short stint there that wasn't very successful, and I'd love to read more.
He was homesick,
more.
Like, and Newcastle is further north.
Yeah, I'd love to read more on just exactly what went down there, and I suppose that was several years ago now. Maybe he's matured a bit more, maybe he's, you know, grown up a bit more, which is a weird thing to say about a man in his 40s, I guess, but it is a bit different for professional footballers who grew up and played for their local club. You know, as well as the fact that he's been out of management for a bit as well, and that he had that successful stint at Bournemouth. Maybe he is deciding now it's time to flock from the nest a little and spread his wings and fly over north to Newcastle, which you know, I'm not too inspired by the way they're currently running things at the moment. Obviously, we've talked about the ownership there and my lack of inspiration over that as well. The other thing that doesn't really click for me as well is, first of all, that they were initially going to appoint Unai Emery, and the two managers that they've swapped between, once Unai Emery went, they went for Eddie Howe. Like, they're not very similar at all, so it speaks to a lack of philosophy there, which, you know, doesn't surprise me. But the other thing as well is that of the players there, obviously there's a couple of former Bournemouth players there, in Matt Ritchie and Ryan Fraser and what's his name? Wilson. Callum Wilson. Yep. You know, players he's worked with in the past, you know, Fraser and Wilson were amazing one year there. They were one of the best partnerships in Europe under Eddie Howe one year there. So, you know, maybe he can get those to click again. But then I look at the fact that he's not got the best history when it comes to signing players. And this is a team that needs to sign players. And he's also not got the best history in organizing a defense. And really, in a relegation battle such that Newcastle are in, they need an organised defence because they leak so many goals at the moment that it's just, it's going to sink them if they keep conceding like they are now.
Yeah, like they need to shore up things. They need to redefine how they're playing, and they need someone to come in relatively quickly. You know, the season is just a third in at this point, and there's a lot of football to play. But you can easily get trapped in that sense that you're going down a la Norwich. So, yeah, they need to do something relatively soon and make that call. And I think it's coming in the next week or so.
And I suppose the interesting thing or the exciting thing is that it gives us plenty to discuss heading into Christmas. You know, it's not very. Last year it felt a little static, I guess, after the chaos had kind of settled. So, you know, there's plenty to discuss going into, I suppose, we have an international break now, but coming out of that, we'll have a lot of clubs to keep an eye on. So I'm looking forward to all that. So
taking fast in only 12 months to the Qatar World Cup.
Yeah, until then we've got an international break, the last of 2021 to settle, and I suppose we'll figure out some stuff to discuss next week. But until then, thank you for being here, Andrew.
And thank you for having me, Declan.
And we'll be back again next week. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then don't forget you can tell family and friends about the show. Spread the word of the Total Football Takeover. This show can also be found on podcast services including Spotify by searching Total Football Podcast. You can also subscribe to my own Medium page in the show notes. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at Conbon27, C-O-N-B-O-N, and myself at Cheesy Heartpun, C-H-E-E-S-Y-H-I-R-T-E-P-U-N. Most of all, thank you for listening, and we hope to be in your download feed next week too. The more the merrier. That's what we always say.